Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. Happy Thursday! Happy fucking New Year. You can still say that, right? Of course you can. It's February. We're not too far removed from January. Man, great episode today. Holy shit. Talk about a comedy legend. Somebody who has been in the game and been crushing every aspect from being on David Letterman 25 times, Johnny Carson, Jay Leno, wrote and won Emmys for her work on Seinfeld, worked on The Ellen Show, wrote for Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin for the Oscars, wrote on SNL, and has a new book out called How to Succeed in Business Without Really Crying, which, man, Brad and I both read it. I did the audiobook. He read it. I cannot recommend this enough. Our guest articulates and captures the essence of the entertainment business, as well as just life lessons through her experiences. We talk about just one of the benefits of stand-up in our world, and the things you can learn that you can apply to life are invaluable, and only through our business. And she captures it incredibly in her book, which you got to get on Amazon or iTunes. Go see her live when she's doing stand-up. She'll be on my Adam Ray and Buddy show at the Comedy Store in March. And I'm talking about the one and only Carol Leifer. That's right, baby. Carol Leifer making her ALN debut and crushing it. This was just one of those classic episodes where the stories are great, the laughs are solid and frequent. And Brad and I learned a lot. It's like so many poignant things in this book that you guys are going to be able to take with you. So enjoy the hell out of this episode. Follow Carol on Twitter at Carol Leifer. Follow me on Twitter at Adam Ray Comedy, at Funny Brad, at ALN Podcast, at Adam Ray Comedy on Instagram, ALN Podcast on Instagram, Brad Williams Comic on Instagram. Tour dates, holy shit, I'm hitting the road Saturday, February 11th, Detroit, the Fillmore Theater. That's the start of the Adam Devine Weird Life Tour, baby. February 11th to March 4th. Man, 3 weeks. Theaters all around the country. Can't fucking wait, man. Going to be Facebook Living a lot, doing some pods from the road. So make sure you follow me on all my social media so you can see some behind-the-scenes moments from the tour. And it's going to be a fucking blast, dude. And then, of course, when I get back from the tour, March 4th, which we will end at the Wiltern here in L.A., and then I'm on the road a bunch after that. All my tour dates at AdamRayTV.com. I'll be headlining Gotham Comedy Club in New York City, March 10th through the 12th. Co-headlining the Addison Improv in Dallas with my boy Amir K from Mad TV, March 16th through the 18th. And then headlining the St. Louis Funny Bone, March 24th through the 26th. And the San Francisco Punchline, just added, April 5th through the 8th. Can't wait. A lot of great shows, a lot of great cities, a lot of great clubs. Can't wait to get after it and build the hour. Getting close to a special. How close? Don't know yet, but some cool things in the works, and the hour is getting close and tight. Brad Williams, this weekend is not on the road, but February 16th through the 18th, he's in Syracuse, New York at the Funny Bone. Go to funnybone.com. Go see Brad February 16th through the 18th at the Syracuse Funny Bone. And then February 23rd through February 25th, Brad's in Raleigh, North Carolina at Goodnight's Comedy Club. So go see Brad there. Merch coming soon. As I told you, Brad is working on it. We will have that new link up and ready on the aboutlastnightpodcast.com website. In fact, it might even be up right now. Brad actually sent me something. I think it's actually up and running. So go check that out. Get your ALN shirts at aboutlastnightpodcast.com or email us at aboutlastnightpod@gmail.com if you have specific merch questions and inquiries. Huh? Man, so many great episodes in the tank. We've got so many great conversations that we have stocked up because I'm going to be on tour and we can't record any episodes for 3 weeks. Ryan Sickler, Justine Marino, J. Chris Newberg, TJ Miller, fucking some other big ones I can't mention. I just booked a job on my favorite show on TV that I can't say, but I will just say that. And we might get whatever. Look, just know that there's some really great shit coming down the pipeline. So make sure you're subscribed on iTunes. Make sure you also subscribe to my other podcast, Good Call with Josh Wolf. We just had Jonathan Coachman on, the ESPN SportsCenter anchor. Michelle Beadle from Sports Nation is on next week. And Joey McIntyre, my boy from New Kids on the Block, is going to be on the week after that. We recorded that episode today, and a lot of Patriots talk and a lot of shit talking. Joey's show, Return of the Mac, which I play as manager on, a single camera comedy, Curb Your Enthusiasm style, will be premiering on Pop TV April 12th. So make sure you're tuned into that. That's coming up soon, and Joe will come on the ALN podcast and promote that for sure. Now that we got the tour dates out of the way, those are the Twitter handles, and that's the merch info, and the Good Call Pod info, and the Return of the Mac info. So guess what? Sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with the one and only Carol Leifer.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. It's about last night.
I mean, is there a bad Bette Midler story? I don't think there is.
No.
Because, like, does anyone tell the story? Like, one time I met Bette Midler. She called me the N-word, punched me in the face. Craziest story ever.
Yeah.
Like, I
weirdest Thanksgiving of my life.
Like, I don't think there's that story.
Yeah, no, you're not going to hear that. But, should I just launch into my Bette Midler story?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't have to be introduced.
I mean, we do a whole intro at the top.
You do?
So we just, and then we just kind of go.
Okay.
We have an intro and a theme song, and then it just goes into the episode. Yeah.
Because you just told me a great Bette Midler story.
I did.
Yeah, you did.
I told it off air.
Oh, you did.
Maybe I should read.
I think you should.
Yeah. Well, the long and short of it is, and by the way, it's great. I mean, I love that I even have a Bette Midler story.
Yeah, how many people do? Not many.
That's going to be on your gravestone. Here lies Adam Ray. He has a Bette Midler story.
You know what?
I was just talking. Two out of three people in one spot. That's really unusual.
Yeah. God, step your game up,
I gotta keep up. All
right. Live a cooler life. It's
well,
gonna be on your gravestone.
Bet, if you're listening, which I assume you are,
yeah,
why wouldn't you be? Well, how about this? Bette Midler doesn't have a Brad Williams story. Well, how about
fair
that?
Enough. Fair about enough. That? Well, you don't know that.
All right.
Well, that's true.
It's like, okay. I mean, does she need one? She's Bette Midler.
And I might not even have one after this podcast.
This is true. My first interactions with a lot of women, they probably say the same thing. So
nice.
It's fine.
So it was at Melissa McCarthy holiday party, and she showed
right
up.
Right there. Okay, but stop right there.
Right.
That's pretty great.
That's pretty cool.
But you know Melissa McCarthy because you've been in her movies. But
three movies.
I didn't know that you have a friendship with her.
Totally.
Amazing.
It's, you know, it's one of those things, and, you know, you have so many great points in your book that we'll get to, but, like, one about, I mean, when I got on the set of The Heat, it was like all my scenes were with Sandra and Melissa, and I'm sitting in the chairs, first movie, first, like, time on a set where there's that much downtime, and in my head, I was like, all right, I'm going to, like, feel this out. Like, obviously, I want to chum them up and become best friends with them. That
all
is
right.
The goal here.
Of course. Everybody's goal.
Right. But I don't want to, like, overstep boundaries or, you know, be that guy that's chumming them up when they're clearly not. But, you know, being a comic, you get good at reading the room on and off stage, I feel.
Absolutely.
Like. So
it's one of the skills.
Totally.
Of a comedian.
The life skills we learn from stand-up are, like,
incredible.
I feel almost bad for people that aren't comics because I'm like, there's so many social situations I have navigated through because of stand-up.
That is so true. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Crying, too.
Are you already working on a sequel?
Just in my head, not officially, but...
I bet you will.
But we should talk about
that. Okay, good.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I'm sitting there, and they have their iPads, and they're doing some stuff, and they're chatting, and then... They started saying something to me, and then there was like just like some silence for a little bit, and then I was like, you know what? I'm not just going to sit here. This is like awkward, and it's not my style to just sit and be quiet. So I started chumming them up, and they were so sweet, and it took a little bit. It took like a hangout outside of the set to really get it going.
Right.
Booze helps.
Booze helped a lot, yeah. Melissa got nice and tossed one night and was doing a rap about my beard and was grabbing me and like, you know, and it was real. And then the next day or 2 days after, and I remember I was like, man, you remember that rap about my beard? And she goes, you were there? And so that was a good laugh. And then it was kind of like.
But you know what? In just hearing about this right now, you know, that could have really gone a different way because you obviously felt out the situation and knew it was a good time to jump in and try to be chatty with them. But it could also have gone a way where you started chatting with them and they're polite, and then 5 minutes later she goes over to the AD, the assistant director, and goes, make sure the guest actors do not chat with us.
Totally.
Chat with us. And so somehow you avoided that and leapt over to Friendly Town.
Yeah. And I think there's like, I mean, and it definitely, and it everything you say is like carries so much weight. So, because you're like, all right, the first time you try to interject and be funny in a conversation, like, it better crush. So yes, that they're exactly. like, okay, cool, he can stay here and keep his name on that chair.
right.
Not just silence.
But so, so then after that it was, you know, and then again, just seeing her at some parties and whatnot, and you know, texting here and there. But, and then again, like you, like, you know, preach on like keeping, like sending notes after meetings and just like following up. Like it's all on you to do that.
Exactly.
Melissa McCarthy doesn't need to reach out to me, but it's like, once you get a certain level of rapport, it's like, all right, well, I'm going to like text here and there about, you know, when she was Sean Spicer on SNL recently. Or,
oh, my God. Which was, that was the funniest thing.
One of the greatest things I've seen comedically in a long time.
Yes, when she comes off the stage and starts ramming the reporter with the podium,
oh my God.
I lost it.
You know
it.
What? I am dying to know if that was in the script, if that's something she came up with. That's the brilliance of it. I just dying to know.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me if it was completely.
Because she's so locked into that world of, and also just making choices. And she's like, is it such a locked in point where she trusts herself so hard where it's like,
right.
And also with the show, they're probably like, yo, if you think of something to do, like, obviously just do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's such a freedom at that place.
Well, you know.
I know from having written there.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
For how many years were you a writer? And then we'll get back to the Bette Midler stories, which we will get there.
I was there for only a season, but it's actually a story in my book because I learned a big lesson from that year in SNL. Mm-hmm. And it was, like in retrospect, I look back now, I got a lot of stuff on. I got, you know, sketches on with Tom Hanks and Angelica Houston and Dudley Moore and so many people. But I was hired by Al Franken.
That's
then
amazing.
Just comedy
Senator
writer.
Al Franken.
Senator Al Franken. And Jim Downey, great, who was there for years.
Legendary writer,
And, of course, Lorne Michaels is the top of the food chain there, you know, the head captain.
And that was his comeback season?
It was his comeback season after Dick Ebersol took over for 5 years.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I always felt like I never cut it with Lauren. I just felt like he didn't like me. I just didn't feel like he responded to me. And as a young person with my first comedy writing job, as a result, I kind of like kind of scattered whenever he'd be around. Mm-hmm. Instead of now that I know, as someone who's been at it for a long time, I would have like fought my instinct and been like, well, if he doesn't like me, or I get the sense he doesn't like me, I'm going to show him that he can like me. I'm going to put my best foot forward and not avoid him and fly under his radar. So at the end of the season, I actually didn't get invited back. And I kind of look at it now as a mistake that I made in my kind of way there at SNL. I should have, instead of avoiding Lauren, really been front and center and tried to get him to change his mind about
now, it. I mean, obviously that's easier said than done, right? Like,
it is.
Because I wonder,
especially with Lauren,
I also wonder, like, was it your just young person insecurities of like, oh, he doesn't like me because we're not best friends? Or was it really, were there things that he did or the way he looked at you where you're like, no, this guy has a sour taste for whatever reason. He hasn't gotten to know me and that's why he...
I felt like he doesn't maybe know me well enough yet.
Right.
But as a younger person, because of that, that made my insecurity and shyness amp that up as opposed to, oh, I'm going to try to hang out.
I'll stay out of his way because he doesn't like me instead of like, well, let me show him who I am and then he'll like me.
Exactly.
And that's one thing I want to emphasize to our listeners, why they need to go get your book, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Crying.
Yes, thank you for saying that correctly.
Yes, because there is a musical which I was in. I played Mr. Twimble. Thanks for asking.
Hey, anyway. I was in too at USC. It was the only musical I did, and I was in the ensemble, and I could not dance, but I smiled a lot. Kelly Ward, who was in Grease, who was the director, goes, you obviously can't dance very well. He goes, just smile a lot, and people think you're having a good time.
And that worked. Huh?
Great advice.
I got a lot of compliments.
Fake it till you make it.
My mom and her Jewish friends.
But one thing you go into is, this isn't like a show business advice book, is there's a lot of lessons that can be translated just into life in general.
Yes.
And that you say in the book how you need to look at those relationships and not how they can be used to your advantage, but like Adam said, you can't just wait for the relationship to happen. You have to be kind of proactive, whether it be making conversations, making time, showing shared interest, or just following up on things. And that can help you not just in show business, but just in life in general.
Yeah, in everything. I mean, because as long as I've been in comedy, which is a long time, and I have a, you know, knock wood, a really long career, I've seen so many talented people who, unfortunately, their people skills were not great,
yeah,
and didn't get as far as they could because they didn't work on the people skills that I talk, you know, at length about in mm-hmm. my book that are so important. Conversely, I've also seen people who are minimally talented who really weren't that great but got so far because,
well, I mean, you just met me. I don't know if that's really nice to say.
And he keeps using this shore thing as like some crutch, and it's just not panning out.
See, now I have my Brad story.
There you go. Done. But and that is like, and we've seen that as well, where that's where they say it's show business. There is a business side of it, and you can be extremely talented, but that's not it. If people don't like you or don't even know you, or you don't make an effort, mm-hmm. then they're not going to think of you when they get a show and they need a writer or they need a performer, or even someone to open for them on the road. Like Adam and I are touring headliners, and people ask us if they can go on the road with us, and we always think the same thing, like, A, are you funny? B, am I going to like spending time with you?
Yes, exactly. Well,
are you a good hang?
Right. Yeah. I talk about that from, you know, writing for Seinfeld for all the seasons I did. You know, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld hired people that they thought were funny, mm-hmm. and they also hired people who were, quote, an easy hang. Because you're together so many hours, and you can be the funniest person ever, but if you are not good in a room and people don't like hanging out with you, you'll be gone.
Can you be in a writer's room and be funny, not like for the sake of the show, but be funny and just be like necessary to be in the room to like riff and banter, but maybe you aren't as good structurally? Or
yeah,
do writers ever hire people like that for shows? Just to,
I think, you know, kind of not. Kind of court jester, kind of to keep things right. rolling. You know, you have to, you know, any writing staff I've been on, there's always kind of everybody with certain strengths. There are certain people who are good structure strengths. Mm-hmm. Like I worked on a show where we used to call this guy, you know, Beautiful Mind, because you'd have some ideas and then he'd get up to the board and he'd just like map it all out.
Wow.
And then people who are great, just joke writers, just great punch-up joke writers, mm-hmm. and other people who have, you know, really good character story sense. So it's kind of like a mix of a lot of people. But you always like people around who you like to be around.
Yeah. Your book, this is one of the most poignant and, like, I mean, I'm going to reiterate things you've heard already, but, like, to get that business side of things, and just, I mean, obviously, like, this is all coming from experience, and it's like the things that I wish I would have known, like, starting out, like, this book had been around,
uh-huh.
like, graduating from USC in the acting school, we had one person, Henry Winkler came and spoke to us at the end,
okay.
and then,
my friend Henry Winkler.
Henry, yeah.
Yes.
He gave me advice for my first TV job.
Wow.
When I got a guest star on According to Jim, and I called him, and I go, because his son Max was in my fraternity.
Oh, okay.
So I met Henry, I've told the story before, but the first time I met him, he comes in, he goes, it was father son weekend at the frat, and he comes in, he goes, excuse me, I'm Max's father, and I have
a good Henry.
I have a bag of laundry here, and I would love to, would you mind getting it safely to Max for me? And I go, yeah, no problem. I go, by the way, you're the man. He goes, great, I am Henry Winkler. And I go, I know. I go, you're the greatest. He goes, yes, can you get this bag of laundry to Max? He goes, you're not gonna do any funny business with it, are you? I go, what? He goes, like, no one's gonna shit in the bag, right? I go, what? I go, this is my second year in the frat, but I haven't seen any shitting in bags.
Not like, now, but that's a great idea.
Right. He's like, no weird, you guys
Thanks
do.
Thanks for planting the idea. Yeah.
He's like, you guys do weird frat stuff, so no shitting in laundry bags. I go, no, I guarantee. He goes, can you promise me no shit on his clothes? I go, I'm giving you the Adam Ray stamp of approval. And he goes, great. And then he gave me a hug and gave me laundry and goes, all the best.
Oh my God. And well, then, he is the nicest guy.
The nicest.
Yes.
And when he left me, when I did According to Jim, and I called him, I was like, Henry, you've obviously been on sitcoms. Like, do you have any? And he left me this voicemail. And like, had I had the wherewithal to save it, it would be like, right. it's something I'd probably listen to every day, because it was Adam Ray, Henry Winkler. Congrats on the gig. You're going to be great. Uh-huh. They booked Adam Ray because they love Adam Ray. Don't be there just to fill space. If you think of something funny, say it. Treat Mr. Belushi like an emperor. All the best.
Wow. then best advice.
Best advice. Yeah. And then cut to a moment where, you know, first sitcom, live audience, right, unbelievable. Right. They're rewriting the whole end scene. People are pitching jokes. I have an idea for a joke. I'm standing on the outskirts. Director Belushi, Courtney Thorne Smith. And I'm like, say it, say it. Henry, I hear Henry being like, you think of something funny, say it. Yeah. And I go, what about this? And say it. And I wish I remember the joke. But I remember the feeling of everyone just looking and then right back to like, how about we come up with something else? And in my head, I was like, God damn it. And I almost heard Henry in my head be like, well, you tried.
That's what he would have said.
Yeah. But they came to speak at the end of USC and they give us some business insight, but like not, I mean, and there's so much you learn from just doing, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Would you say like—
Absolutely. And like, the mistakes, you know, I write so much about the mistakes that I made that in retrospect I wish I had avoided, like really kind of feel like giving people the wisdom that I learned from falling on my face. Mm-hmm. But actually one of the big pieces of advice I give in my book is like, you know, failure is not bad. Some of the greatest things in my career have happened from failure, you know.
Yeah.
Like you don't get a part and you're defeated and this is the worst news you've ever heard. But that person remembers you for something else down the road. I mean, that happens all the time.
But you never think of that in the moment. I mean, it took me forever to even, you know, apply that to walking out of a room. And because you're just so in that moment, you're thinking of that one thing, right?
Yes. And it's all connections. And I always encourage people to just keep doing what you're doing. And if you fall on your face, it's okay. It's really fine because something really amazingly wonderful can spring out of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it right then, but it can.
Sure. You can get a part or you can not get a part, but then because you have that time off, then you get another part for a greater show that you actually wanted.
Absolutely.
That isn't just a paycheck. So, yes there is, and the only way we learn, like especially with stand-up, stand-up I feel like it's this constant video game where you're going down the level and you go, oh wait, okay, there's a spike there that comes out of the wall and it hits you, so when you do it again, duck and cover and don't get hit by that spike. So it's constant failure just so you know what to avoid in the future.
Absolutely. But I think your point, Adam, about, you know, the greatest thing, stand-up has given me so many great, like all of my careers, my writing career spanked, you know, from my stand-up, so I give it so much credit because it's really at the bottom of my DNA. But talk about people skills that you learn from stand-up. I mean, you know, when you perform, the audience is like a baby, you know, where you sometimes feel like, oh, I need to talk to the baby a little bit.
Yeah.
You get the rattle out, and then you shake the rattle, and then, oh, no, the baby's upset. Ooh, baby needs to be changed, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like you have to always monitor where they're at and how you have to change your game to fit theirs.
Oh, my God, this baby hates Trump jokes. I should not do Trump jokes for this baby. This is a red state baby.
I was this baby, not pro-choice. Yeah. There really is just a, and it helps, I mean, in relationships, like, I mean, reading the room in those situations. I think also, too, there's a blessing and a curse. Like, there's been relationships where I have gone for the joke more so in, like, a tense situation.
Right.
And, and you know, and...
I think we're all guilty of that,
you know,
one.
Dated a girl who was in grad school for clinical psychology. And we got into an argument, and I think I said something along the lines of, quit treating a relationship like a class. And you know what? Funny in the moment to me, not so funny for the relationship.
Yeah. No.
Things to Not Say by Adam Ray.
Yeah.
One of the things I really resonated with, which is something my mom spits out constantly and has for a long time, and I've said it on the podcast, and she says, she's been on this, shout out to my mom, Puddin. She, a Jew from Oklahoma, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
A handful out there.
They make them there.
Oh, my God.
It's a small factory, but I mean, they come out just as shiny as in New York. It's great.
Is she in the Ripley's Museum there?
She is, yeah. They should have a Ripley's,
Jew.
Believe it or not, they're Jews museum.
A Jew from Oklahoma, believe it or not.
So she, but it was the advice of, you don't ask, you don't get, right?
Oh my God.
Like at a young age. Yes. And so, and that was maybe the only thing that business-wise that I've really, that she's advocated that I've taken from like high school to now. And I mean, it helps for, you know, podcasts with booking people,
right.
And with, you know, just being proactive. But then as we've learned and you talk about, there is that balance between like being a pain in the ass and being proactive.
Exactly.
And
it's like the squeaky wheel either gets the grease or is a huge pain in the ass and you throw the bike out.
Yeah.
You know? But
haven't heard that part of the story.
Do you have experiences in both worlds that gave you that insight?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, something that I talk about in the book that I feel like is kind of a big secret, but I think it's like so important is, and I use it all the time, is, you know, what you're saying, you don't ask, you don't get. So much of everything is about being proactive and being your own biggest advocate. But when I ask people for things, and I'm on both sides, people ask me for favors, people ask me for jobs, but I also go up for jobs, and I'm on the other side. So I always feel like a big secret is a way to approach someone, I think, is always better when you say, would you consider? Like, blank, fill in the blank. Would you consider me coming in and pitching some story ideas? Would you? Because when you say, would you consider, the ball's in their court. It's not threatening.
Yeah.
But as opposed to if I see a producer out and about and I go, can I come in and pitch some stories? Like, right away, you feel like,
yeah, well, I want to do this, right?
Yeah. It just is so off-putting.
It kind of eases your way into it.
Absolutely.
Or I will watch you sleep at night if you don't let me, you know, insert, you know, job. You know, I will,
yes.
Yeah.
I will be outside your window watching you sleep. But speaking of Trump, you know, I was on Celebrity Apprentice.
You were on Celebrity Apprentice.
I mean, what the fuck?
Yeah. And,
so you got hired by both a Senator Al Franken and President Donald Trump.
I never thought of that before.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Brad.
Two Brad stories.
Yeah.
Boom.
But here's the thing. I mean, you know, a lot of people would not remember me from Celebrity Apprentice because I was the first person thrown off. And, of course, when I got the gig, Chuck LaBella, the talent guy from NBC, was like, oh, we want you to do Celebrity Apprentice. Like, oh, fantastic. I said, I just don't want to be that loser that's thrown off first. He's like, oh, that won't happen.
That anyway, won't happen. But then you just didn't make the ice cream fast enough.
Well, you know, it's a long story, but I got thrown under the bus by those bitches.
You did.
But here's the thing. You know, when you're fired on Celebrity Apprentice, and it happens, you know, right there, it's not planned, and it's like, I could see it coming, oh, he's about to say you're fired, and I was like, I'm not leaving here without something for my charity, which was North Shore Animal League.
Yeah, that was a big move. I love that you did that.
And I just said to him, before I go, Mr. Trump, I know that you're a fan of North Shore Animal League, because he had told me that, and I said, would you consider giving them a donation? And he said, yeah, I'll give you $10,000. So, you know, I left Celebrity Apprentice first, but I got a giant donation. But even that, would you consider giving a donation? How much better is that than, will you make a donation?
Yeah.
Like,
I think it's fair
money
if you do this. I mean, it's so crazy that just that phrasing is so. And also, it does put a little pressure on, because would you consider? I mean, now it's like, all right, like, this is kind of like, this is a nice thing to do. Like, would you consider? And
yes.
If you don't consider
it
or do it,
that's okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I think you can ask anybody anything like that if you give them that out. You know, if they feel like, well, if I say no, that's okay. Then you can really ask.
Then I didn't consider it.
Yeah.
It's not so much pressure of make the decision right now. You're actually saying, would you consider is, would you even think about the making the decision in the future?
Right, exactly.
You've been on Bill Maher a bunch, which you're phenomenal on. It's like one of my favorite shows.
Thank
Have you known Bill a while just from being a stand-up?
I know Bill from day one.
You were on the same, you're on the same Young Comedian special.
We were.
I know that.
Yes, we were on the same Young Comedian special. I mean, what's amazing is, my, you know, stand-up audition stories. The first day that I auditioned at a club, it was still there, the Comic Strip in New York City.
Great
Jerry
club.
Seinfeld was the MC and put me through. And when I auditioned at this club that's no longer around, what was amazing, called Catch a Rising Star, the MC that night
legendary was
Larry David, and put me through. So I literally, go back. My
and you've
first
been friends
day
with all these guys all your entire
Since
career
then.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
It's, well, you know, it's like coming up. I always love to talk to comics about who they came up with in their kind of hometown club, because it's really kind of like being family.
Yeah, because I mean, no one knows your struggles and what you had to go through more than the people that went through it with you.
Yeah,
and those people that were in the trenches, and even looking from like, okay, well, you came up at the same time as me, but you were in X city, I was in Y city. It's not exactly the same experience,
right.
But if you came up in that same city, then you know the same bookers, the same open mics that you all went to, the same crazy comic that booked it that you kind of like, that paid you in cocaine. happened to me twice. So you have those shared experiences, and that's I believe Seinfeld was only MC for a year, but he was already like booking people or something.
You know, it's amazing. He'd only been doing stand-up for a year, but when I got to the Comic Strip, he was already like a rock star there. And it was amazing because not only that, but he always worked hard on, his act. Like, you know, we were a bunch of comics in our 20s coming up, and every day we'd just screw around. And he would every day like look at his watch and go, I need to go home and write. And we'd all look at him like, nerd, you know. But it's
wow,
like,
yeah,
he really always had an amazing work ethic, so no one was ever surprised that he made it so big, because he's always had this monster commitment and, you know, work ethic towards stand-up that he still has.
People just don't. And obviously when the documentary Comedian came out, like, that to me was so incredible, because people do, and, you know, I did it before I saw that. You look at people like that and you go, oh, they were always that great, you know?
Right.
But you don't, because you don't get to see the behind-the-scenes work that's put in. And even if you see them at a club, you're just like, again, you're like, he's always that funny. He's always been, you know, Will Smith has always been that buff, or, you know, Whoopi Goldberg has always had that hair's always been that shiny. And so, but then when you get to really see like the grind that goes into it, you're like, oh yeah, like you have to, Seinfeld still had the talent, obviously, but like had to make that commitment. And it's, and unfortunately, like, you know, now with so much more access, like, there's, I think people, whether it's like, you know, they're on Vine or YouTube, there's like fast tracks they feel like they can take, or
without having to put the work and really develop that skill.
Like, there's people trying to transition into stand up from like Vine and YouTube that are like, oh yeah, I can do it because I'm doing it, like, and it's,
there's no substitute for it. You gotta get on stage. You know, when I started out, I had a real rough patch with a lot of bad sets in a row, and I really thought about giving up. And a great comedian at the time, Stephen Wright, came over to me and said, Carol, you got to do it every night for 3 years, and don't judge yourself. You just commit to doing it every night.
Don't judge yourself.
Yeah.
That's huge.
And it made so much of a difference, because it's that time that you put in. And even now when I do stand-up, you have some nights that are like, I come home, it's like, oh my God, Honest was the greatest. And then other nights, like, I just wasn't hitting it with them. It's just, and Jerry Seinfeld always made that analogy to me. He was like, a great ball player, a great average is like 3-something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which he said is,
three out of 10.
Yeah, exactly.
If you hit 3 out of 10 times, you will be one of the highest paid hitters in the league.
Exactly.
Which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, you use that advice from a god like that.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense.
What I was going to say with the Bill Maher stuff, have you always been that politically, I mean, just informed and involved? And second part, you're doing a lot more stand-up now, right?
Yeah.
Has that been charged by just wanting to get back on stage and the desire for that, or also because of just like the state of the...
Is this going
to
air before this Saturday?
This will air... Wait, what is today? This will come on Thursday.
Oh, great, because I'm co-headlining the Improv this Saturday night.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
With Kevin Pollak.
Yes.
Oh, that's a great show.
I just watched your chat show with him. That was so great.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that was fun.
Oh, great. 8 o'clock?
8 o'clock.
Perfect.
Yes. You know, I really got back into it because I just wanted to, you know, when you have an act that is working, where you go out and you do it, you know, it sort of becomes like, I would joke around, like, it's like doing Oklahoma every night, you know, where you're kind of there, but you're not there. And I was like, I really want to write a lot of new material and be in the moment and be able to do more gigs where I feel like I'm more myself. My act has gotten a little stale to me, so it's been so much fun to go out and do new material night, you know, with Neilan, and get up on stage, because you know, we all know there's nothing like it. I mean, the highest high,
And
it can also still be the lowest low, but there's nothing like getting out there in front of people.
And even someone who's been at it as long as you have, there's still... Nothing gives me a greater thrill than writing a new joke and it working. It's still the greatest feeling.
Yes.
There's still no substitute for that. I've not found anything that comes close to writing a new joke, trying it that night, and then it hits and you're just like, I have a new toy to play with.
Yeah, it's the best feeling. And what I love about it is when you write those jokes at home that day, that was the joke that you thought, oh, that'll get nothing. That becomes the biggest joke now in your act. And the thing that you thought, oh my God, I'm going to do this joke, it's going to kill, it's going to be the centerpiece of my act, and it dies.
Yeah.
You just never know.
Yeah, never know. Yeah. Now when you talk about political issues, are you worried at all about dividing audiences, or maybe having a group of people now not want to come see you because of a certain point of view?
My stand-up, I mean, when I've done more, I've been political just because it's a political show.
Yeah,
but when I do my stand-up, I really don't, you know, get political because, you know, Jay Leno is also a great friend of mine and also been a real Yoda to me over the years and has given me some great advice. And, you know, he's like, when you get political, for every fan that you have by being that position, you also alienate somebody else. Yeah. So why do it?
Yeah. And I've always had the viewpoint of like, I don't know. I just I see the comedy club and that whole scene as like an escape for people. Like they're trying to get away. I mean, they, you know, they do appreciate you making, you know, light of things that might be dark. But at the same time, like, you know, I have a few things that I'm trickling in here and there, but it's a few things. And it's like a small chunk just because I do. I'm at the point where I finally, you know, when you get to a point where you're like, oh, I think I know who I am on stage and my point of view, and you actually have something to say about it, that's kind of cool. And you want to explore that.
Yeah.
Selfishly, but at the same time, and I feel like, you know, doing anything topical, you're just really figuring out more who you are on stage because it's right in the moment and you're challenging your writing skills.
Yeah. And I think, too, the thing I've learned over the years is you don't have to be overtly political. You can just be funny.
Yeah.
People will get the politics anyway.
I mean,
you know, I talk about, because, you know, I realized I was gay at 40, and I talk about, you know, my about that, like my life threw me a surprise party, and I talk about, you know, my wife, that we got married a year ago, and that we have a son, and just talking about that, and making jokes about it, and being light and funny about it, is weirdly a political statement without, like, waving a flag on stage.
1,000%
Sure, because you're essentially saying who you are, and obviously, if you say, like, yeah, I just, I mean, I found out I was gay at 40, then you're not going to follow that bit up with, and what's with these gays wanting to get married? These freaking queers. Hate them, right? Like, we kind of get where you're going to go with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did love that joke. I think you said it on The View or somewhere. It was so great where, maybe it was Stern, where you said, I just realized I was single, divorced, no kids, and I wanted to find one more way to disappoint my mother.
Yeah, exactly.
So piss off my mom,
yes. That's such a wonderful Jewish joke, too.
What? Wait. So that at 40, how does that go down?
Yeah.
How does that go down? Well, here's what's wild. I mean, I, you know, was married, I got divorced, and I just had like this. I was like, oh, I want my chic lesbian fling. Like, I really want that to happen. And I went to this Project Angel Food charity dinner. And I sat across from this, you know, woman who I thought was gorgeous. And I was totally, like, smitten with her. And I thought, oh, this is who I want to have my chic lesbian fling with.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like,
chic lesbian fling. That sounds...
It's a documentary waiting to happen.
Right. That sounds so wonderful. Like, it's a fragrance.
Yeah. Like a Ben and Jerry's flavor.
Yeah, sure.
And, and lo and behold, you know, here we are married 20 years later.
Crazy.
I mean, yeah, it's really, really wild.
Those stories are, by the way, that's so crazy. I mean, like, you know, obviously, like, your intentions were different in the moment, but you still were, like, looking at it through this eyes of, like, I mean, there was something that where you just, like, I'm infatuated with this person, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, of course, you know, like, the first trip that we ever took together, we went to Hawaii together, and I was, like, so excited, like, oh, wow, this is all going to happen. This is all going down. And, you know, we go to this great hotel, and the bellman is, you know, in the room putting our bags away. And, you know, it's one of those things where the chatty bellman, like, can I show you your, here's your
thermostat. Leave the bedroom.
He's like Zachary Levy from that episode of Curb. You remember that?
Yeah.
And the light switch on and off, and Larry's like, the TV, and just volume up and down.
Leave the bedroom.
Like, going on and on and on, and, my wife, Lori, had this scuba diving bag, and he's making conversation, and he's like, oh, you girls planning on doing any diving while you're here? And he's like, yeah, buddy. You have no idea how much diving.
Not going into reefs, though. Unless you have a muff reef.
Oh my God.
I do have to ask, so was there ever a moment, because you said, like, you know, you wanted it to be your chic lesbian fling, as it was progressing, did you ever, like, say to yourself in your head, like, wait a minute, I'm not gay?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I really had to search my soul of, like, wow, I have all these feelings. And,
right,
you know, I didn't come out to my parents until it was a year, because I really wanted to be sure this was, like, a thing. But, of course, going home to my Jewish parents on Long Island, and I came out to them, and I thought, like, they'd be upset, and they were so supportive, and I was the basket case. I was,
of course,
you know, so emotional and crying. And I remember my father turning to me and saying, Carol, you know, why are you crying? And I said, you know, Dad, actually, because I thought you'd be disappointed. And he turned to me and he said, I'll tell you when I was disappointed, when you married that Gentile.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's so funny.
What a great line.
The fact that, you know, she was a Jew from Brentwood.
Yeah.
It's Break Out the Manischewitz and Soul Do the Horror.
That's so great. Oh, and to once again tie it back into your book, which we can't emphasize enough, people need to go get. You really talk about your parents and kind of how they guided you.
Yeah.
And how they put you on your track. And it's so great to see, because you always kind of assume that every comic hates their parents in some weird way.
Yeah.
But I love seeing when, like, Adam loves his mom. I love my parents, so I love seeing other supportive parents and that you guys have that great relationship.
Yeah, and you know, my dad really wanted to be a comedian. I mean, it was his dream, and he mm-hmm. still to, you know. To this day, I've never met a comic who tells a joke better than my dad.
It's crazy.
But it's very cool to kind of have lived his dream, and that he was so, that he got to see so much of my success, which,
yeah.
you know, it was really great when I did the Letterman show for the first time, and my dad saw, at that time, you know, my name in the New York Times and the TV listings. He was
God.
I cried like a baby.
Yeah, that's got to be insane. Because what was he a fan of comedically that you... that kind of influenced you, like, early on, do you remember?
Well,
like, listening to albums?
Yeah,
or?
Comedy albums, you know, I'm of that generation that my parents, you know, I think it was one of the advantages of the way that I grew up back then. Like, you listened to what your parents listened to. Nobody had their own earbuds. It was like, the parents were the DJs.
Right.
And my parents had great comedy taste. I mean, we listened to, you know, Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner album and, you know, Alan Sherman, who was a guy who was a pop at the time. Yeah. My dad would call
so Jews.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
we are the funniest bread.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, not bad choices.
Yes. Yeah. No, legends. Yeah. No.
Exactly.
Really, really knew his stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, I also worked for him, you know, at his optical shop. And, you know, when your dad is your boss, you get such a different perspective. He was such a great boss. Like, to this day, when people would be in the waiting room, my dad would always come out, see people in the waiting room, and go, hey, you know, hi, everybody, we're going to get to y'all. Sorry about the wait, but I'm going to get to you. And even today, when I sit in a waiting room and, you know, and they just ignore you or they don't say anything, I always think of my dad would have been like, you got to tell your customers it's okay. And you know, well, they're there.
And you know what? That's so great. I love that you bring that up, because I do that in my shows when... if like the show starts late, like if it's like it's like the 10 p.m. show and it doesn't start till 10:45, I tell the MC, like, go on stage and say thank you for waiting, thank you for thank you for being patient.
So smart.
But hey, the first show ran a little long. You know your show is going to run a little long, so we're all going to have a good time tonight. Something along those lines. And every time you do that, everyone, even if they were having any thoughts of this fucking guy, like, it's like, it's good.
Exactly. It's just because that you've acknowledged them and also that they're waiting. And just, that's as simple
as
that.
Pretty much the equivalent of cutting someone off, someone's mad at you, but then you wave at them, they're like, oh, they waved.
Yeah.
Okay, it's good. Yeah. It's good. I can't be mad at them now.
Right. I will not road rage them.
I was reaching for my Glock. But now,
I think it is so important to just to comment on, like, being influenced at a young age with comedy, don't you think? Like,
absolutely.
I showed my half brothers at maybe 8 and 10, Family Guy. And to this day, they are hilarious and have such. They're so into stand-up. They're so just, like, always sending me things that they find that are funny. And I'm like, I for sure contributed to that.
Right.
I mean, you know, and maybe for the worse, like, who knows? We'll find out if...
I think Seth MacFarlane had a hand in that, too.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Who were the first, like, comedian that you saw that you said, oh, that makes me really want to do that?
Eddie Murphy Raw.
Wow.
That's special.
Probably Eddie Murphy Delirious for stand-up. John Belushi. My dad showed me a best of John Belushi SNL. Yeah, and also Sinbad, old tape, but it was the Belushi where it was like seeing just the act, like in a sketch and with other people, that it was just like, that is some, like, it was just, it was mind blowing. I mean, I was like, I must have watched it 5,000 times.
Oh my God.
Well, because when you're a kid, you do that. It's so amazing how as adults we kind of churn through entertainment so fast,
mm-hmm.
and we watch it, we get it, and you watch a comedian special, and then you write him a note on Facebook saying, "Hey, when's your next one coming out?"
Yeah,
you're like, enjoy this for a little bit.
Right.
But and then as a kid, you can just you watch the same tape
over and over
every day. That's, and still.
You know,
love
it's a great documentary I just watched. Have you heard about this one about, it's on Showtime, about National Lampoon?
I was just about to watch that. Is it?
It is so, so good. Oh, and there's so much Belushi in it.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
oh, good.
Yeah, but,
there's not enough. I mean, I know they're working on a biopic, but I mean, it's just like, that guy was, you know.
Yeah, like a flash.
Did you ever get to come across him?
I never met him, no. Mm-hmm. I went to a early on, Alan Zweibel and I became pals when I was coming up as stand-up, and he was a writer at SNL. And I remember I went to, he brought me to a taping, and I went to an after party, but it was the same thing. I mean, you know, I was even shyer then to like go over to anybody. But
I want to know how, there's so many things, by the way. That,
and we will get to the Bette Midler story, I promise you.
Are you good for another like 25 minutes? Are you,
Another 25?
To 145 or what?
145 is fine.
Okay, great. Okay. There's so many things in the book to talk about. And I also don't want to regurgitate stories, but there's so much stuff to get to. And the book is, where's the main place people could get it? Just
On Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com.
Yeah, you can go to AboutLastNightPodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner. You can order the book, and then we get a couple shekels as well.
Yes, oh nice.
By the way, do not sleep on the audiobook, which is what I did, and that was phenomenal. You have, I mean, such a great storytelling voice,
oh,
and it's so
you.
Easy to listen to, and it's just, I mean, for me, I think that's, you know, I don't know, that's the, if there's somebody as entertaining as you doing that, like, I feel like that's the route.
Wow.
Did that take a while?
Yeah. You know, when you record an audiobook, what is great about it is you get to read your own stuff.
Yes.
What sucks about it is anytime you make any kind of like mistake or go over a word incorrectly, you got to do it all over again. Oh, so it was a little like, you know, I spaced it out over a few days or you'll go out of
your lose your mind. Just reading the same shit. But I mean, look, I mean, when people read it, it is fun to like read it with your own voice, but your timing isn't better than Carol Leifer's, so listen to the audiobook is my suggestion. But I want to know, because I met you through Mad TV.
Yes.
What was like, I mean, from being SNL sketch and then that, first of all, how did that come about to get that job? And then I want to know, like, what were some differences that we can talk about experience-wise?
Well, you know, just having written for SNL, my agent just last spring said they're very interested in you coming aboard Mad TV staff. And, you know, getting back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, you know, I'm also a fan of like just, you know, doing things to also just, if there's any trepidation, I always say to myself, just do it, you know?
Yeah, things that scare you.
Because it's going to lead to other great things, like sitting here and meeting you and a million other great people. So basically that's what happened. And I had a meeting with David Saltzman, who, you know, has been with Mad TV, the executive producer, since the beginning. And we worked on it. I mean, what was amazing was it was only 3 months to shoot 8 episodes.
Yeah.
And I've never worked on a schedule like that where it's that kind of turnaround. But, you know, in retrospect, it was a great experience, and so much so because of the great people that I have met and worked with and will continue to work with, you know, moving forward. I mean, have you heard if we're doing any more?
I check in semi-regularly. I know that they want to. Mm-hmm. They want to do, like, some specials, and they're on the fence about a season, and so I think, which to me is... It's like, we'll do both. And like, I guess it did like well enough in its time slot, despite like, you know, I mean, lack of promotion and the quick turnaround and all that. So, and you would think too, like giving everybody a chance to gel like that, like any show.
Right.
You should, especially with a franchise like that, if you're going to bring it back, like should do a few seasons to let people, to really see what it can be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that seems like, I guess, easier said than done, because I'm not an exec, but.
But I will really say, Adam, that you were such a bright spot on the show. And I'm not just saying it because I'm sitting here with Brad doing your podcast.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, it was, I mean, it was, you know, it was an honor to meet you and have you, like, you know, be writing stuff that I would get to say. And also, you complimented me about separation anxiety, which I never get to hear.
What was that?
The game show with Eliza.
Oh, my God. Oh,
hilarious.
That's right.
What if it wasn't you? What was that? I didn't even
I never watched that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You said you'd caught it somehow. Yeah. On, yeah.
Right.
The TBS game show.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Are you doing more of those?
No, I seem to have a good pattern of one and done.
No, that
it's
was
like the
a
John
really
Calipari.
Good, you were really, you're a really good host. I mean, you're so talented as a comedic actor, and I still have to see your stand-up, but you were so good on that.
It was fun. Well, it was, you know, the, I guess apparently TBS wanted to make it more sexual and more like Newlywed Game type, and I know Eliza wasn't a huge fan of that.
Okay.
And then they also, I heard, wanted like a more Steve Harvey older type host for the main host.
Right.
And I you know, that just really was mind-blowing, because I was like, it's kind of great that you have two comics as hosts.
Yeah.
That
that can go back and forth and
are hosty enough and, yeah, but without right, being right, totally secresty. But you now, speaking of hosts, and also I think it's dope that you EP'd Better Late Than Never.
Yes,
with our boy
I
Jeff
did.
Dye. Yes. And I mean Winkler and Foreman and
right,
Shatner,
right,
and
right,
who's the last one?
Terry Bradshaw.
Yeah.
Well, of course, with your Henry Winkler story, you know, I went to Asia for 5 weeks with those guys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Dye, you know, a comedian who is a contemporary.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so much fun and so wild to travel with those guys. It,
from the stories he told us, I can't imagine, like, I mean, if you're going on any sort of like trip after that, I'm like, I don't know how you're topping anything. Like, it just sounded like the best crew. Everyone was doing things that were out of their element, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How does a show like that, how do you get attached to it? And then, I mean, is it another thing that scared you that you were like, I'm going to do it? Or were you in on the ground floor?
What was great, well, you know, talk about things that, you know, people don't realize. They just see Better Late Than Never on the air and go, oh, this is a funny show and it's so great, you're part of it. I mean, it started 2 years ago where people, all right, I was thrown off Celebrity Apprentice, of course, which was a super duper giant failure in anybody's book.
Did a part of you like hearing you fired? Like, were you like, oh, cool, I got, or no, was it just so?
Well, I did also, because people don't realize it's so intense to be on that show. You are working 6 days a week, like 16-hour days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, there's no like, let up in sight. So it was a little like, well, we all get paid the same. Okay, fine.
Yeah, and you got 10 grand for your charity.
And I got 10 grand
so,
for charity, right?
Kind of a win.
Yeah, it was a win-win.
Yeah.
But, you know, the guys from NBC remembered me from Celebrity Apprentice, and they were looking for a comic who could punch up and think of funny situations and for the guys and go along on the trip and kind of, you know, think of it as a bit of a sitcom, like situations we could get the guys in to surprise them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got the gig. But what was amazing was 2 years ago, there was another cast member that NBC wanted to add, and then at the last minute, it didn't happen. And so the show went away until the following summer. So, you know, same thing. It's like, we were all destroyed. Like, oh, that was a great idea for a show that never happened. And then it came back. So, like, you just never know
what's going to happen. And even going on Celebrity, going on Celebrity Apprentice.
Right.
You get to do that job from that.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And also, I want to emphasize your ability to be flexible in terms of the type of comedy that you do, whether it be writing for a sketch show, which you've done, whether it be stand-up, whether it be writing for a sitcom, which, hello, Seinfeld.
Yes.
Okay, so which you've done that. And then writing for an awards show. You wrote so many times on the Academy Awards.
Yeah,
which, now that that's coming up again, like, I can't imagine writing jokes for that show, because it has to be so, you really can't offend anyone. It's got to be like so vanilla. Like, were you pressured in those situations to like push the envelope? Or,
you know, it depends really on the host. I mean, so much of that gig is volume. You just have to constantly be writing jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a pretty quick evaluation from the host of what they, but it's really like, they probably get from all the writers 100 jokes every day when you're in pre-production. Yeah. And you just have to keep rolling on. I think the funnest thing about that gig when I've done it, and I've done it seven times, is
wow.
You know, when you're backstage and the host comes off and something has just happened and it's like,
I need something for this.
Yeah. Whoa.
So
do you have a bunch of jokes ready in that moment, or are you just
in that moment? Yeah, whatever.
You kind of have to
pitch, and it's kind of like survival of the fittest. Whoever gets out there and gets the joke that the host goes, yes, I'm going to do that. But a lot of times when I've worked on the show, they put me also in the green room because of being with the celebrities and kind of going over their bit, because I always felt like I was very complimented that they felt like I wasn't intimidated of a lot of celebrities.
Yeah.
So I would kind of go over their thing with them and then kind of be a little bit of, you know, the disciplinarian, like, well, oh, I want to change this. It's like, oh, you know, it's so late in the process. I don't know if we can, like, you know, kind of standing up to the celebrities. But
that's got to be hard and intimidating when, like, Sean Penn goes, that's not funny. You're like, trust me.
You're like, Sean Penn, you don't know what funny is.
Funny.
You know what? I really give the celebs, you know, a lot of credit because, you know, they go out and they're, most of them, they're actors. They're not as, you know, they don't go out as one like we do as comics.
Right.
And they're petrified. They're so
they really
nervous.
Are, huh?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see it up close and personal.
It's one thing to do it on camera in a closed set. It's another thing to do it when you have a packed Kodak Theater, or Dolby Theater, whatever the hell it's called now. But yeah, when you have all those people now looking at you like, oh, this is a different animal.
Right.
And if you don't have that, if you don't have the live audience chops from doing either Broadway or plays or something, then it can be intimidating.
I've really found that they've always been really kind of trusting about, like, if you go out there, I really have a good feeling, this will be good, this will work, just believe in it. And they take your advice because I think, you know, it's funny to see them in that kind of vulnerable state, you know, but it's always been so nice and, you know, just a giant thrill.
Didn't you go to Steve Martin's house?
My God. Well, I wrote for Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin that year.
I mean, that's bonkers.
Yeah, and he's like, Steve is like, oh, let's have the writers come up to the house and I'll write today at the house. And I, you know, literally turned to my wife, Lauren, and said, okay, I'm going to Steve Martin's house today to write jokes. Like, that was my pinch me moment of, like, if I had ever told myself in college that this would ever be happening, I would never have believed it.
Right.
And also still turns out to be one of the nicest, most decent guys. I mean, I have a blurb from him that's, you know, right in the...
You gotta read some of those.
...inside flap of my book. And, you know, what's amazing is when I sent... I said, oh, Steve, would you, you know, be so kind as to give me a blurb? He was like, well, send me the book and I'll read it. And then I was like, lucky enough, he's like, oh, I have jury duty next week, I'll read the whole thing. And he did.
Steve Martin has jury duty?
Yeah.
That's what I get from that story. I can't imagine being a lawyer going, ladies and gentlemen, is that Steve fucking Martin in my jury box? Yeah. Like,
well, something had just happened too. I said to him, don't turn it to Tom Hanks, because Tom Hanks had just done it and people were, like, you know, all over him asking for autographs.
Yeah.
But
I know Oprah did it at some point.
Yeah.
Oprah did jury duty.
Yeah, we live in America.
Steve Martin says of Carol's book, a remarkable memoir that's packed with anecdotes, advice, and humor, all while maintaining a high level of dignity and self-awareness. From Steve Martin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who...
That never gets old. Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to come back.
I would love to.
Yeah.
Anytime.
You're amazing.
We can go off on Seinfeld stories. I
have
talk
to come back
that.
To tell the Bette Midler
story.
Oh, you have
look
to.
Look at that tease. To be continued.
Yes.
And also, we've got some shows coming up that you got to get on stand-up-wise, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you going to try to do a late-night set?
You know what? I really like going
like
on
should.
Early.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because...
No, I mean, late night sit on TV, I mean.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant, like, clubs. doing spots.
Like a Tonight Show or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the great talent guy from the Tonight Show is so nice, and I've been saying to him, you know, I want to show you my stuff, but I want to get it down to,
totally.
Like, the best thing.
It's a good move.
Yeah,
and will this be, if you do the Tonight Show with Jimmy, will this be your third Tonight Show host?
Yeah, let me think. Well, I did it with Jay as host, Johnny.
Yeah,
yeah.
Wow,
it will be.
I don't know. I don't know how many people will have that feather in their cap, but I think you almost have to do it just for that reason.
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
But you never did stand up on the Bonnie Hunt show, and that's going to be your one regret.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for making time.
Thank you,
You're
guys.
The best.
It was really fun. So...
listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamay Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.